Danny is revisiting a presentation he did in 1994. Was Steve, were you at that one?
No.
Was anyone at Danny's presentation at the SPS? Oh, one at the back. Two. Brilliant. So you remember it well. This is an update of that. And it's on resolving the geographical problems on inequalities. And seeing he's had 24 years to think about it, I think we're going to have a good answer today. So please welcome Professor Danny Dawley.
Thank you ever so much for that. I'm going to rattle through these, partly because I don't actually answer the questions that I promised to try to make myself do it, but I've got a lot of things to show you. But my real purpose in doing this talk is to try to galvanise somebody who was like I was in 1994 to try to solve the problems I'm about to show you, because it needs to be done. I should, before I forget, acknowledge the people I've been working with on these issues in the last two or three years. They're Dom Harrison, who's the Director of Public Health for Blackburn and Darwin. Dom has to direct public health for Blackburn and Darwin, so he doesn't have that much time. Martin McKee, who's president of some epidemiological society and has two diary secretaries and is always flying around the world. And Lucinda Higham, who's a part-time GP in London, who's done most of the work, parts of which you're going to see, but is currently working for Médecins Sans Frontières in a refugee camp in Jordan while still writing papers on this. So I don't want to guilt you, but we've got a problem, and it's changed and it's become bigger, and there's now lots of data, which you like. That's Lou phoning in. Today, if you get bored, click on the BBC website, news, click on the health tab, and click Public Health England's report on the state of the health of the nation, which was published today on the 11th of September. You will see nothing in it on what I'm about to show you, and that is part of our problem. Some context, rapidly going forward. Back in 2012, people like me were still worried about things like this. It's these two graphs, one to men, one to women. It's the gap in life expectancy for local authority districts in England from the best off district to the worst, and the gap was getting bigger. And people like me annoyingly moaned about the Labour government saying inequalities are rising, it's terrible. But the point is that even in the worst off area then, things were getting better. And this is how things have changed. And that's only 6 years ago. 7 years ago, we have events like this. This was the announcement that 752 care homes might have to close. You might remember this kind of thing. Loads and loads of things came together, all of which may have had an effect. We're not going to be able to disentangle all the effects. We can certainly rule some things out of what I'm about to show you. But it's just too much bad news all at once. December 2012. These are the kind of signs that things were going wrong in the care system. This is an email sent out by one of the privatised healthcare firms who'd been given an NHS contract, basically offering to negotiate a rate with any doctor willing to do the night shift that night in that particular part of the country. I told you I'd rattle through these, but this is to give you an idea over time of the kind of sequence of events. 6 years later, Andrew Lansley is complaining that the Treasury didn't do what he as Health Secretary said they should have done, and hence his bowel cancer wasn't screened personally. I picked this story up from a few days ago, September the 6th. Pregnant mums have been turned away 17 times from a maternity unit up in Lancashire, one that Andrew Lansley personally promised he would keep open. It is a kind of story of things falling apart. Things have fallen apart in Britain. Between 2008 and 2013, almost 500,000 old and disabled people lost their care support because of the cuts. Well over a cut of well over a million visits a year. These visits, they're not particularly useful, but if you've fallen down the bottom of the stairs, at least somebody finds you at the bottom of the stairs, or somebody can notify a GP that there's an issue. You're probably aware of this, but in case you're not, and if you're not from the UK, this may be news to you. Coming up to date, one of our problems is that initially the flu was blamed. And the problem with that isn't so much that the flu was initially blamed, but if you're an institution and you blame the flu, there's a great tendency to want to stick with your original explanation. This has happened before. Harold Macmillan blamed the flu for the deaths to do with smog in 1953. Flu's been a convenient scapegoat. March this year, even if March the 16th this year, Public Health England was saying a number of European countries have had similar experiences this past winter to the UK, it's nothing special about Britain, supporting our belief that this excess was largely attributable to influenza. Thankfully, they've stopped saying that now. But all the way from about start of 2013 through to March this year, this special kind of flu was being blamed for what I'm about to show you. ONS, I don't know who it is in ONS, I'd love to know, they're doing a sterling job. ONS produced analysis showing when the breaking slope in the trends occurred. The breaking slope of trends occurred in 2010. And somebody is doing a brilliant job in the middle of their reports of putting in lines like this. Influenza activity remained at median levels throughout the whole of January and February 2018. You know, they're trying to tell Public Health England not to do it. And I'm very, very grateful for that, because without what ONS have been doing in recent years, you know, you would think, oh, we're getting it wrong. This is what a flu epidemic looks like. Or at least what they looked like in the past. When you do get a bad year of flu, it's quite a fast thing. You go from almost ill, 5 weeks you hit the peak of the peak, and then it comes back down again. It's about a 10-week event for an unusually large death to be due to influenza. Just in case you weren't aware of what a flu epidemic tends to produce if you have a flu epidemic. And we may get a flu epidemic. And, you know, Lord only knows what happens if we get a flu epidemic on top of what is really happening. You know, that is not good, but that's an image of them. They affect people of different ages depending on whether those people were exposed to flu in the past of the same kind and so on. Here's some graphs. These appeared in the New Statesman in 2013, just showing the fall in things like the care that we were beginning to give then. This is tiny compared to the cuts since then. It's not all due to cuts, by the way. It is things fell apart, lots and lots of things went wrong. This is the very first life expectancy fall for one group. I think it's women from 65, and it's a tiny number of weeks dropping down. My best guess is the difference between women and men is that a man over 65 tends to be living with a woman, often younger than him, looking after him. A woman over 65 is much more likely to be living on her own because the man she was living with has died because he was older than her, and men die earlier. I think elderly women saw this first and hardest because they're on their own. And the extent to which you're affected by the cuts is in many ways the extent to which you are on your own. You don't have family nearby to help, because when the state reduces, when the rural bus services go, when Meals on Wheels no longer exists in your area, so people don't turn up and actually give you food at lunchtime, if you've got a partner, particularly a partner who can get to the shops, or you've got relatives nearby, it's not as bad as if you're on your own. The first time we saw the NHS indicators showing this is this target 1A, the top target of the NHS, it's years of life loss for males from avoidable causes. This came out in this very blurry diagram in an NHS report in January 2016, basically showing that it's flatlining. The NHS is failing to improve mortality and the things that it can most directly influence. There's also just coincidence and cock-up. The point at which it stopped being a, you know, odd people like Danny are speculating based on very, very small amounts of data in a few weeks of life to, oh my God, something enormous has happened, was the day of the result of the Brexit referendum. That was the day that ONS released the mid-year estimates, because that's the day that ONS always released the mid-year estimates. And understandably, discovering that 52% of the population voted Leave was a slightly bigger story than the worst health disaster since the Second World War. And it is, in a way. You know, I mean, and the coincidence of those two things being released on the same day. So nobody noticed that 52,000 more people had died, because we were all thinking, what on earth is going to happen next to this country as it leaves the EU? You can read there the increase in the rates of death, which are standardised by age. You see that they're quite dramatic. We now know that on the death certificate it's dementia and Alzheimer's. And in a way, a little bit like elderly women living on their own, people with dementia and Alzheimer's are also one of the, in a weak situation in society. The flu was not there in any significance in terms of being on death certificates. And people were telling us, and we didn't see it, people were telling us that something was wrong with their health. These are the four measures that are used in the happiness index. David Cameron in 2010 announced that we're going to have a happiness index to check how much happier he's making the population each year. It's a composite index made of 30-odd variables, but the most important ones are health. And this is what happened to the health variables. And I think it's from Understanding Society, from 2009 to 2013. And you can just see it dropping. When I showed this to George Davy Smith, who's a very good friend of mine, George Davy Smith said, artifact. And he said, artifact, because this never happens. He said, it's not true, it can't be true, that never happens. Whenever you see that, it's a mistake and it's an artifact. Now, there was a change in coding between the middle 2 years, in that it was a anonymous type into a computer rather than tell somebody thing. But as you can see, that doesn't actually matter. So people were actually saying that their health was getting worse before they started dying in higher numbers. And one really interesting thing about this whole episode is that we have lots of bodies who are charged with producing data, monitoring data and so on. We have nobody at all, whose remit is to say something about it when it looks bad. We have four chief medical officers, but they don't appear to think it's their job to cry wolf, if you like. You know, we have various chief executives and chief nurses and chief knowledge officers, and somebody once asked me who's responsible, and I produced a slide of 22 senior executives in Britain who have job titles that implies they should know something about this. But in the letters from the Secretary of State, it doesn't say you have a duty to shout if something's very badly going wrong. If you're excited by the data, that's the data, but the new thing is at the bottom. The most recent data still gets it going wrong in terms of people saying that they're not doing well, apart from Scotland. Scotland is interesting, Scotland is different. Scotland also, before I forget, has managed to get its infant mortality rate better than England for the first time in decades, quietly. But I probably won't say. I'm going to show you one more picture of Scotland in a second, and then I not say much more. Other things happening in society, and okay, this is happening worldwide, but it's happening more here than in Europe. This is Prozac in a sense. Proportion of people taking Prozac. In somewhere like Blackpool, it's a third of adults. And we know it's worse in America, but it's much better in other countries in Europe. I'm trying to give you an idea of the complexity. Towards the end, I'll come down to some simple things we could work out. This is the dashboard of The Economist magazine. And it's hospital waiting time targets, local care provision, teacher recruitment being missed, so but it's basically their kind of what's happening to society. And it's going wrong. Here's your long-term trend. there's no better audience in the world than you lot who knows about why this looks like it looks, and we can talk about smoking in the past, and we can look at that relatively. There's a period there in the 1960s when men's mortality didn't improve very much, but that is when the men were really smoking very heavily 30 years before. This tailing off, this slide is a year old, it gets more dramatic more recently. That's the most dramatic slide. So you can go to sleep after this if you want, but that's the one to, this is the one to remember. Released by ONS, it's the age, sex, standardised mortality rates for quarter one each year. ONS on August the 7th released figures for life expectancy for men and women for 20 countries. Our life expectancy peaked for the UK in 2014 and has been lower ever since. And you can see here on the age, sex, standardised mortality rate why 2014 was the best year, the best it got to. That, you know, outside of Russia after 89, and those kind of disasters, you don't see that kind of thing occurring elsewhere. The shares in undertakers went up dramatically. And they've actually gone down a bit recently because there are a limited number of people, of course, you know, you can only die once. But the shares of undertakers went up because they've become forward. Temporary morgues were installed in Surrey. People have been commissioned to produce very complicated and flashy dashboards for various local authority districts, you know, with infographics. And that's just showing you what one of the dashboards looks like. You know, it's supposed to subtly show you the complex mixture of things going right and wrong. And the whole thing goes red. And we don't have a model of what to do when it goes red. The little graph nearer me is just showing you cuts in London per head in funding for services. London's the area that's doing best, by the way. But that's the cuts in London to services. A&E performance failing. And of course, it fails most at the winter when the need is greatest, but it's not looking good. And these are the kind of graphs of life expectancy for the countries tailing off or going down. And there's a couple more years to add to that that haven't yet been added. I mean, one reason I'm not worried about over-exaggerating this is that we know from the weekly mortality counts what's coming next when the rates are calculated and what comes a year later when the life expectancies are calculated. And that's for women. And you could maybe say, when you sort of first saw that 2 years ago, you could think, oh, it's a blip, or the USA is doing it as well, or it's happening everywhere. But it turns out it isn't happening everywhere. This graph here, Lou and I put in the BMJ for the first 16 weeks of this year. The remarkable thing about the first 16 weeks of this year, that's 20,000 extra deaths, is that was the period where, for the first time ever, all routine operations in the NHS in England were cancelled for weeks and weeks and weeks to stop there being a rise in death rates. And we got the biggest rise in death rates, death numbers, and we can later work out rates. And you can work out rates now, just taking the ONS projection of population. So what you've got to ask when you look at that is, how much worse would it have been if we hadn't cancelled all routine operations? I suspect cancelling routine operations was actually a very sensible thing to do, but it would have been worse. If you're wondering about why there are a couple of weeks which aren't so awful, one is timing and holidays, and the other, I suspect, is that the people who were processing the death certificates got too much of a backlog to keep up. Because the number of people that there are to process the death certificates and numbers has been cut as the number go up. ONS, this is part of my kind of fanboy thing about ONS. I like ONS more than ever before. Somebody from ONS on October 13th last year stuck this infographic up of neonatal mortality rates between 1990, when the UK ranked 7th of all these countries, to 2015 when we were ranking 19th. When I was born, you were three times more likely to die as a baby in Portugal than England. Portugal was the place that was seen as the worst in Europe. If you've got very good eyesight, you'll see Portugal going from 16th up to, and I obviously don't have very good eyesight,
eight.
Okay, at the same kind of time. This is not the babies of immigrants. Immigrants are healthy. And since then, since 2015, the overall infant mortality rate, led by the neonatal mortality rate, which this is showing, has risen significantly 2 years in a row. So that ranking 19 is going to zoom down. If it were to carry on at the current rate it's been going since 1990, we cross over with Romania by about 2025. And this is why we need some help of looking. You know, this is quite a dramatic event, and there will be different reasons for the babies than for the older adults and so on, and an all falling apart kind of thing. The thing I think we should be looking at here is midwives and maternity services. You know, these are deaths of babies in the first few days of life. And there is a link, of course, to immigrants. 30% of the midwives of central London are EU but not UK citizens. You know, why would you be a midwife somewhere you can't afford to live unless you were coming over and it was a bit exciting and you did it for a few years? But our ability to help babies be delivered safely relies on midwives who are coming largely from the continent to mean that you have just enough to keep maternity units going at peak times. That's the last graph of Scotland. This is this year in Scotland, and that actually does look like an influenza spike. For the first time, we've got one that looks like an influenza. The England one didn't look like that, but the Scotland one possibly did. But we can't tell. The grey line is the average for the last 5 years. Remember, the last 5 years was awful. And so when you have the red line on top of that, it's not at all good. This is my crude attempt to say how bad 2015 was. And 2018 was worse than 2015. So these are mid-year to mid-year rises in a single year in deaths. The worst year since we recorded deaths well in 1832. The worst was 1918, then 1940, then the cold winter of 29, the great frost of 1895, the cholera of 1846, the cholera of 1849, and then 2015. But it's different people dying. It is mainly elderly people dying 2 or 3 years earlier than they would have otherwise died. It is not as dramatic as those other events. If you do it calendar year to calendar year, it's a 7% rise, not a 9% rise. Some of these labels have slipped lower down because 1851 was not flu, it was cholera. 1951 was flu on the list. It hardly matters. Given that this has happened again in 2018, it should be seen as being of grave importance. The wider picture here is life expectancy along the y-axis in, I think, 2040, it's a recent life expectancy, 2015. And alongside an inequality measure from way back in 1983, the take of the 1% in 1983. There are long-standing things going on. The black circles are US states. The grey circles are affluent countries, other affluent countries. The interesting thing here is if you were to show just the states, you'd say there's no relationship. And if you were to look at just the European countries, you'd say there's no relationship. But put together and you get a relationship. You could look at other measures of inequality than 1983. The measure of inequality you really want to use is one that covers, on average, the entire lifetimes of people. Because life expectancy is affected by things that have happened, well, even before birth, but of course throughout your life. Th- things fall apart. We're used to living here. It's remarkable how quickly human beings adapt to rapid changes of circumstance. The best example to think of is the Second World War and how quickly people got used to the idea that they were at war. We are amazingly adaptable. So, you know, the current crisis that's happening, you're not out in the streets saying this is terrible, it's just kind of, oh, we've run out of money, you know, we just accept it. This is the OECD's most recent league table of inequality. I, as you may know, am obsessed by inequality. It's not the explanation of everything, but countries that have big gaps between their populations tend to be getting a lot of things wrong. A Gini coefficient of 0.5 is what you get if you have a country of just two households, where one household gets 25,000 a year and the other household gets 75,000 a year. So imagine living in that. 25,000, 70,000. Think how you'd get on with each other. That's Mexico. Right, Mexico's not doing well, Chile's not doing well, Turkey is not in a happy place as a country, might agree. The United States is not doing particularly well. Libya, Latvia, and occasional years Estonia bumps up there, and they're interesting, but I won't say any more unless you're interested in that. It's partly a reaction against the communists and a kind of, you know, liking of inequality. Russia, you may disagree. I think Russia is a failed state at the moment, very unequal. I don't think Israel is doing a particularly good job of happily dealing with all its people, let's put it that way. And bang between Russia and Israel is us. But we're used to us. So we don't think of ourselves as somewhere that's become like that. And I won't bore you by showing you the reams of other countries. The best is Finland, but there were lots of them. Our colleagues in the Netherlands are probably going to get very annoyed about this because, you know, everybody concentrates on the problems in their countries. In Japan, people complained about the rise in inequality. We could only dream of having Japanese levels of inequality. Things that have been missed so far. You all know about suicides in prisons and so on, and when people die in police custody, and immigration removal centres, which looked like it was getting better, but the last couple of years, not yet in official stats, have got worse. Nobody's done anything on this, and it's about to surpass the deaths in prison. And it is falling apart. Now, it isn't actually quite as bad as that, because although by law, coroners are supposed to look at every case of somebody who dies under mental health detention. They didn't realise it until the last few years, but it still actually is a rise. We've looked into it in detail. And just to show you one case, before we just forget, you know, these are thousands of houses of numbers. This is a case from near where I live. This is Connor Sparrowhawk, and Connor Sparrowhawk, known as Laughing Boy, drowned in a bath when nobody was looking after him in an institution a mile from my house. Connor has a tenacious mum, and Connor's mum managed to take down the part of the health service that was responsible for this, and it's been on the news, but that's just one case. More warning signs. A paper by colleagues up in Liverpool on infant mortality rates by social class came out over a year ago. It was the poorest babies first. So the people with Alzheimer's and dementia, the people in mental institutions, the oldest women, and then the babies of the poorest social classes is where it began. But of course now it's overall infant mortality. Okay. If you want the second graph to concentrate on, it's this one. This was released on August the 7th of this year. And I think it's the one for women, it's just as bad for men, and it's the blue first of all we look at. The blue is the increase in life expectancy comparing the 6 years before 2010, or in the 6 years since 2010. And the two countries which have done the worst by far are the UK and USA. Netherlands does much better. All the Public Health England statements about this is happening everywhere else in Europe were blown out of the water when ONS did this. ONS took the human mortality database to do it. I should have done it, but I'm getting old and I can only use Excel now. SPSS doesn't work on my computer anymore. We should have done it. Why should ONS have had to go out of their way to do something that you could actually do in a day, but no academic did? And so you can see over this period, countries like Japan, which already had one of the highest life expectancy in the world, were still rising, Finland rising dramatically. So that's, for me, this is the kind of final nail saying it's the UK and USA. It's not like the USA, we don't have the same kind of opiate problem they have in the USA. We haven't had flat wages for 3 decades for half the population. But whatever we have done, the outcome in the last 6 years has been as bad. The question is, why on earth that yellow line is so long? Why did we see such a huge improvement in our life expectancy in the 6 years to 2010? And that's why I want to look at migration, because we know migrants tend to be healthy. And what happened in the 6 years before 2010? Who came into the country? How many of them came into the country? What physical state were the people who came into the country? And could it possibly be that the health record of the United Kingdom looks far better than it should, because it includes 3 million healthy, relatively young, highly qualified people from the mainland of Europe, and we chucked out 1 million of our affluent retirees to go abroad? Nick Clegg's dad, David Cameron's dad, both died in France. And I think that's one thing we need to begin to look at to try to understand part of the process, because it's no longer looking like a temporary process. Here's the 2015 event again. This is the percent point absolute rise in mortality. And one reason it hasn't been such a scandal, it's the same as why all the deaths now associated with Harold Shipman were not a scandal. Elderly women, first of all, elderly people, so very different. The biggest rise for 90-year-olds, they're 90-year-olds, but that's the percent point rise. If we look at the relative rise, you get a clue. And the relative rise, and again, the older you are, the bigger the relative rise, the more frail you are. 25 to 29 didn't have a rise in 2015. Now, either it's a special kind of flu that didn't affect 25 to 29-year-olds, or there's something else about 25 to 29-year-olds in 2015. And I'll give you a clue. 60,000 of them had just arrived from the mainland of Europe. It's the age group of peak immigration. So an age group not affected so much by what's happening. These graphs are turned sideways just to confuse you or wake you up, but they're only there so that you can smartly believe what I'm going to say. The poor person who published this 2 weeks after the referendum was mercilessly pulled apart by the Daily Mail and Express. This is the best correlation with leave, and it's obesity rates. And should have known. There's 0.8 correlation. It's not that obesity. I can tell you, even though my girth is somewhat substantial, I didn't vote to leave. It is not that being on the slightly plumper side makes you more likely to want out. It's that obesity rate correlates with the things which really did matter, above all immigration. The more immigrants in your areas, and the correlation with immigration is almost as strong. These annoying people from the mainland of Europe not only are highly qualified and very healthy, they tended to be thinner. And when you have thinner people turning up in your area, it's not just they're thinner. The rest of you kind of go, oh my God, I better eat a little bit less. I'm being blatant, but you've probably seen there's been lots of nice research about the epigenetic, the spread of obesity and how it spreads geographically, because you get used to the size you are. I put this up because I'm going to do a few slides of looking at the leave vote before we get on to questions. That, again, on its side is a paper that appeared in the Royal Statistical Society's magazine about 3 weeks after the vote. and it's the correlation between the proportion of people with unique surnames in a district, which is a proxy for the rate of immigration, and the vote. And there's no pattern in Scotland. It shouldn't matter, these graphs, whether they're the right way round or not for seeing the curves, but basically I'm weird. And that's just one of the many graphs I could show you to show the rate of immigration. The highest leave votes were in places to which immigrants didn't come. They're not the places you might think. They're not Middlesbrough, they're not Stoke, they're not Sunderland. I wish I had printed out the list, but I'm going to be using it too much over the next 2 years. You could take 21 areas of the north that voted leave, including Stoke and Middlesbrough and Great Yarmouth. 21 areas, and you can add them all up. More people voted leave in Essex than those 21 areas. Then you could take Hampshire, where we are now, and you could take Sunderland, and you could take another five large northern cities, and more people voted leave in Hampshire, and Hampshire overall voted leave, than in those. And then you could take Kent, okay, a bit easier. And by the time I go through the rest of the home counties, that's it. The home counties voted us out, but also people don't actually come in those high numbers to the home counties. But that's a Brexit thing and a different, but it is really interesting how we have people who get to write the narrative have decided to tell a story that it isn't people near us, when in fact, absolutely, the vote would never have happened without the home counties around London voting in such large numbers to leave. Here's a graph the right way round for you, because you need to look at this one a little bit more. On the y-axis, you've got the percentage voting leave, and on the x-axis, you've got the IMD, the deprivation score. The correlation's 0.03. And okay, you can see something there, but the correlation's 0.03. I'll just leave it up for a bit. And what you've been told is to concentrate on Stoke and Great Yarmouth and Hull. But you take out those big home counties and it's different. Okay. The reason for showing you that is going to this. This is my only Trump diagram. This was produced by The Economist after the election of Donald. They did hundreds of regressions to try to find the what best predicted the shift in the vote by US counties. These are counties. And an index made up of change in the health status of the county. Best predicted counties that swung to the Republicans and hence towards Trump. And it wasn't the health of the individual voters. The voters are generally better off white men, but it's better off white men in areas where the health of the population around them was declining. In other words, where the area was probably declining in general. Not as good, very crudely done, but this is the leave vote on the y-axis, and a very crude percentage, it's on this axis, the x-axis, and the mortality rate. So the more people who voted leave, you get a bit more rise in mortality between Q1 2016 and Q1 2018, 3 months to 3 months. These are huge increases, 20% more deaths. I actually sent an email to Steve Smallwood saying, has there been a kind of reverse Dunkirk, of small boats arriving on the south coast of England, bringing elderly people in for Spain, that we haven't measured in the International Passenger Survey? And as far as we know, not. So that is the rise, and there's a rough correlation. But I'm floundering about with things, trying to work out what's happening. Perhaps the most useful thing is to look at the geography of large areas and the change in mortality. So the biggest increase in mortality recently, on an increase that's already happened, is Lancashire. And then East Midlands, West Midlands, the two most outvoting areas. And at the bottom, Inner London, and London, the smallest. But then Merseyside, Greater Manchester, West Yorkshire, smaller rise. So there's your geographical clues. Not sure what it tells us, but this story is going to have to be explained and written up at some point in the future. And geography often provides clues as to what's going on. But the most important thing to get over for people who didn't know it is that is the rise in the number of deaths in 2 years. There were a tiny number of areas which have actually had a fall in deaths. And it's not ageing. There we go. That's the increase in dying on the y-axis versus the arrival of immigrants in the year to June 2012. This district near me, 6% of the population were people who'd recently arrived. It's large. Roughly it's minus 0.19 correlation. I mean, better than deprivation. But there's a whole lot of things that are going on. But we need to know why the rise happened and why the rise was bigger in some areas than other areas. And we don't know. And at the moment, as I said, you can see it on the BBC website today. The official public health advice about the state of the nation is things are slowly getting better. I mean, that's what people are being told. It's not what the actuaries think. 300 billion 2 years ago came off the pension liabilities of private pensions because the actuaries had worked out that people were not going to live as long in Britain. My favourite, the only private pension not to adjust itself yet is USS. You may think academics and you're immortal. Or you may ask, did we really need to do that strike? And who was it who didn't calculate the death rates correctly for USS? A few other more general things about trends before I sum up. There are many interesting things that affect health. Things such as like your public transport systems affect health. In the US, only 3% of people walk or cycle to work. Walking and cycling is generally fairly good for you. Sitting in a car doesn't lose many calories. And my colleagues from the Netherlands here may dispute the 50% figure, but there it is. And it's a product of 1970s campaigning. Japan, by the way, looks low. Because people say they're going by train because their journey includes the train. It's not that they're driving in Japan. Car ownership in Japan has dropped every year for the last 20 years. The overall kind of story of all of this is going to have to involve factors like that as well. But the immediate work that can be done is working out what does the life expectancy of the UK look like if you don't include people who are not born in the UK. Last one of these ones for you. This is infant mortality. In 2012, relatively recent infant mortality, and again, inequality from way back in 1983. So the claim isn't that this causes this. The claim is that the fact that there's association between these things gives us clues as to how these societies work. Societies that are no good at stopping the top 1% taking more and more money are also quite bad at providing good maternity services and a good environment in which to have a child. And we can look up at Mississippi and Arkansas and Alabama and say, you know, at least we're not there. And that's why we're different from the States, but we're not doing well and we're currently zooming towards the States. That was the kind of thing I was involved in back in 1994. It was trying to work out, once you've taken into account age, sex, social class, unemployment rate by local authority districts, what could you no longer explain? Why were the Glasgow areas red? And one of the missing factors was migration. But there's been so much better work done on Glasgow since then that I'll say nothing else. And the opposite area, down here in London, places where people simply live too long, even taking into account how well they're doing. That's the Clifton area of Bristol. And what is it about those areas back in 1994 that we saw? They're areas to which you can only live if you have enough money to turn up to rent that flat in Clifton. And if you don't have enough money, if you're sacked from your job and you're living in Clifton in Bristol, you've got to leave because the rent's too high. Selective migration has played a part in the internal pattern of mortality in this country. What I'm interested in is to what extent part of what's gone wrong or changed, or why we looked okay till 2010 is partly we were being bolstered by the arrival of immigrants. Just one other reference to work on this. This is Jamie Pierce looking at New Zealand. Is lovely because they asked about smoking, and so you can see, you know, which immigrants survive, where do they go, do they smoke? They tend to be annoying, English, non-smoking, fit, going to the posher parts of New Zealand, and you can work out to what extent that moving around helps explain part of the geography of New Zealand. So that's just some of the things on migration. And that's just a pretty map, because I like pretty maps, which if you read the London Review of Books this week, the magazine, you'll know is completely wrong, because it turns out we didn't quite migrate like that around the world. Human beings will migrate at a remarkable rate. It's just what people do. We're doing a really interesting natural experiment now, where we're making ourselves look really, really unwelcoming. And one effect is a net drop. Is it over just over 100,000 people not coming? The next few years are going to be a time to model how important migration is to a population's health, not just in terms of getting the radiologists and the doctors and the nurses and the people who become the unqualified social workers and so on, but also what happens when you don't have people coming to do your basic catering and other jobs who have remarkably good health. And we're going to be able to find out. Only one more slide to go, so you need to think of questions. And we may even be on time, yeah. Sorry for going so fast. You'll recognise this map from Charles Booth. And you'll recognise that the yellow areas are the servant-keeping classes. Who lost 1 in 10 of their babies 100 years ago. And you recognise, there aren't many vicious semi-criminal poor areas on that, but there are a lot of red, the poor areas that there were. This is near the prison. And one reason why the areas were poor is that when you came out of the prison, you tended to stay nearby and you tended to be poor, but also people arriving, sometimes with their pigs from the west, who then settled in the piggeries in Notting Dale, Fleming. Your Charles Booth map of London is partly a map of migration, of the people who moved into those areas. It wasn't that the good residents of Kensington down there were staying all their lives in those houses. It was that people who were successful were moving into them. It's a map from 1880s, 1890s. So the last image is the same area. You can guess what it is. And this is part of the mix, or the complicated mix, of things that are going on. So at the same time as we've had what I'm absolutely sure is the worst health crisis since the Second World War, we are also beginning to change our attitudes about how we have been behaving and what actually matters. And that's the kind of flux we're in. One issue about that flux to me, and I could be wrong, is if you're trying to understand why hasn't anybody responsible said this is very, very bad? Why don't we have an equivalent of the Chief Inspector of Prisons saying this is the worst I've seen in my life? And it's partly because we have a big political argument going on about what actually matters and whether the gap between there and there matters, or whether the better off the people who live in those houses become, the richer the country as a whole becomes. And because that's part of our politics at the moment, a big political argument about the future of Britain, if you try to talk about the rise in deaths, and if you're writing a chapter for the Chief Medical Officer's Report that will come out in January or February next year, the bits that are cut out of your chapter yesterday are all the bits about the rise in deaths, because you get those going, that's a bit political. It's a rise in deaths. It happened. And I'm trying to understand to myself why this isn't allowed to be said. And I think it's because the country is at this kind of crossroads of where it goes. And it's an inconvenient truth that things are falling apart and it's getting worse. And for people who think we simply don't have enough money anymore, we have to cut, we can't afford to be like we were, if the repercussion is that an 83-year-old dies 84 rather than 87, that isn't quite so bad. Statistically, I think we'll look back at this period in the same way that we now look back at the 1980s and the way that unemployment was reported in the 1980s and dealt with, which is why we need good work being done carefully by people to get it out in numerous papers and to help attribute the explanation as to why Lancashire is the worst hit largest area and why inner London, despite those dramatic cuts to services in London, has had the least rise in mortality of only 9% from 2016 to 2018. Thank you for your patience. Please ask me questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Danny, for that interesting, thought-provoking and slightly depressing presentation. I hope it's given you something to think about and to maybe work on over the next year. We have 5 minutes for questions, so we have a roving mic here. Please say who you are and where you're from. Thank you.
I'm Natasha Shelton from UCL. I was at Fleming's Talk in 1995. I was from the first BSPS conference from Teaching Schools.
Again?
How bad can it get? Are we going to need new demographic models? Demographic transition goes up at the end.
We're pretty unique. I can't find a third country to the UK and the US. The third country could have been France. They didn't vote for Le Pen, I mean, to put it crudely. The UK and the US are in a very weird situation now. And that's good news, because you don't want this to be some international thing. Finland and Japan, absolutely no sign, not a dent, nothing. If it's flu, it's a special kind of flu that doesn't touch Finnish and Japanese people. But when the crash came to Finland, Finland raised its taxes so that there wasn't a single drop in public services, and Finland has the highest taxes in Europe. So there's no need for it to get bad. I mean, the other country that's sometimes mentioned is Germany in 2015. But a very interesting demographic thing happened to Germany in 2015, which is 1.3 million people arrived, not all in a very good state of health, who were looked after very nicely by the Germans. We can look at, I mean, examples, you've got to look at Russia in 89, you've got to look at the States now. Those are the two biggest examples that we got, and it can get worse. You can do the nightmare scenario. I don't want to depress you, there's no need for this. I don't think we're stupid enough, but you know, the nightmare scenario is unplanned, hard Brexit, head in the sand, Empire 2.0, offshore tax haven, billionaires not paying any money in there, and becoming in effect a state of the United States. A pretty good state compared to, you know, their average state. We'd be there with, you know, New Hampshire and so on. But there's absolutely no need for this. There's absolutely no need for this to occur. How quickly could you reverse this is the other question. Given that some of it is about social care and simply making sure that your A&E wards aren't backed out, you could do a lot of good in a very short time, in 12 months, on that kind of thing. The other thing which my medical colleagues hate is, I suspect you could have a psychosocial effect on the population by saying you care. If you remember those, I'll put them back up, the graphs of people saying that their health was getting worse. I don't think it was just that their health was getting worse, but in the years in which they were being asked, you know, we just had the biggest financial crash since 1929. things were not very good in those years, and people may have felt much worse about themselves. The equivalent period is 1945 to 48, when there was a dramatic drop in mortality, particularly suicide rates amongst elderly people that halved, because before you even got the NHS or pensions, you knew they were coming. So I think you could turn a lot of this around very, very quickly. It's absolutely not smoking. There's dropping smoking rates. We banned smoking in pubs. It's not drinking, because the rates of drinking aren't high enough. It's not obesity, because the oldies who are dying are thin. You know, it's our generation who are, that's hopefully a bit of a way off. So this is largely things that can be tackled relatively quickly. And Scotland, if Scotland can show you how to improve infant mortality, if we'd only look to Scotland, we could do a lot of things quite quickly.
Okay. Can I ask a question?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think the impact of the foundation of the NHS has had, where when it was introduced, the infant mortality rates plummeted, mm-hmm. and we introduced a weaker stock, if you like, into the community? Do you think that could have any impact on it?
It's a kind of the golden cohort idea of before. Could that be an, you've got to look at every explanation. You can't dismiss them. But we haven't managed to chart that before. You know, this is sudden. This is sudden. The break point was 210, and there wasn't a hint of it before. The most comprehensive work I've seen is on the famine in the Netherlands during the war. When the bridge too far wasn't won, and people had to eat bulbs. And you can look at that work, and it's kind of interesting, but I'd find it very hard to say that this is a thing. And other countries introduced welfare states shortly after, and of course New Zealand introduced it before us. It's just we don't like to say New Zealand introduced a welfare state before the UK introduced a welfare state.
Okay, that's enough.